WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Well, joining me now is Edmund White, who's written a very interesting book called States of Desire, Travels in Gay America. And the title basically describes what he did for this book. He journeyed in between his teaching experiences around the country to many cities on the West Coast, on the East Coast, in the South, in the Midwest, spending time in the different gay communities in each of these cities, trying to get a sense of what life was like in the different communities, what different kinds of gay subcultures existed, and how life in different places in America compared to one another. States of Desire is published by Dutton. Ed White is also the co-author of The Joy of Gay Sex, and he's the author of two novels, Forgetting Alina and Nocturnes for the King of Naples. He contributes to Christopher Street and has written also for the New York Times Book Review. Ed, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
What did you write this book?
Well, when I was working on The Joy of Gay Sex, my partner and I kept saying to each other, I wonder how this will strike people out there. And we were both such confirmed New Yorkers that we had the feeling that we really didn't know what stage gay people were in different parts of the country. Were they still very, very closeted, or were they beginning to come out more? How do they feel about gay liberation and political questions in general? And even the question of certain sexual practices, for instance, sadomasochism, had it caught on in Portland, or was it only a New York, San Francisco phenomenon? And so this kind of question made me terribly curious about my own country, and I felt that I knew more about Europe than I did about the United States, and so I really had a kind of very fresh, view of America. I felt a bit like a foreigner. I'm one of the few Americans I know who's never owned a television,
never been to a shopping mall,
never owned a car. I went away to boarding school when I was very young, and then I came right to New York, which is like another kind of boarding school. So I had only led this rather cloistered existence, so it was very interesting for me to see what was going on out there.
Of the places that you've been to, which struck you as being the most open for gays, the place with the most alternatives and the most possibilities for being openly gay and for living whatever kind of gay lifestyle you wanted to?
Well, I think certainly San Francisco, New York, Boston, and Washington probably are the big cities on the two coasts, I think, are very much havens for gays. I mean, even a big city like Chicago, I found surprisingly closeted in the Midwest, and certainly in the South, there is a lot of fear of exposure for among homosexuals. So I think that it is definitely the two coasts in the big cities.
You mentioned Los Angeles as being a good place. Why were you enthusiastic about what you found there? What struck you as being good
in Los Angeles? Well, one thing that's interesting there is that many gays who are there, like many straight people who are there, were not born there, and they have moved there, and many of them have become extremely prosperous. And it seems to me that two of the ingredients for people to be really out and to be politically active as gays are that, one, that they should not be living near their families, and the other is that they not be terribly dependent on other people financially. And those two ingredients you see in LA among many, many gay men. So you see very rich gay men who are willing to give a substantial part of their income and their energy to helping the rest of the gay community, to setting up a very good gay community center there where they deal with gay prisoners who are just getting out and trying to find them jobs, with young gays, with runaways, with lesbian mothers, all these different social problems that we don't ordinarily think of as being gay, and that certainly are not the ordinary middle-class gay problems, but are working-class gay problems. Well, anyway, I think that what's remarkable is to see these rich men, usually big real estate lords and so on, and successful professional psychiatrists and so on, turning their interest to the rest of the gay community, to the less advantaged part of it. And that is so different from New York or Philadelphia, if I may mention, where, in fact, most of the well-to-do gay men that I encountered, they have oftentimes inherited a family business, and they're very snobbish. They not only do they not want to acknowledge poor gays, they don't want to acknowledge other gays, period. I mean, they live a very closeted existence in that particular stratum, social stratum. But I think it's important that there be some money in gay welfare programs, and that it should be gay money. I mean, that seems to me very important for the solidarity of the community. And that's one thing you do see in LA, and I think it's remarkable.
What place strikes you as being the most limiting, where it's really difficult to be openly gay, it's difficult to come out in your job or in your neighborhood?
I didn't visit very small towns, so I would suspect a small town in the South would be probably one of the worst places to be. Of those that I visited, I found the most dismal to be Kansas City for gays. It seemed to me that gays were living a life as they did in the 1950s, there were only like 10 gay businessmen in town who were willing to hire other gays. There were very few active gay political organizations. When they had a gay parade there, there were like 20 people who marched. It's just pathetic. And the most enthusiastic gay group there is a secret group called Sisters in Sin of gay men, most of whom are married, and who actively work against gay liberation. The gay bars there refuse to put up placards announcing the gay parade or any gay activities. They say it's too controversial. So it's really very much the way gay life was in the 1950s, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to get into some of the larger issues that you bring up in the book. I just want to preface this by saying that we're talking about gays. We're really talking about gay men, and the people who Ed focuses on in his book are men. Let's talk a little bit about some of the images and some of the stereotypes of gay men. Probably now the most popular look, as far as like clothes and the physical image that you present to the world, is the macho look that I've been seeing a lot of I've been seeing it, I guess, for the past couple of years or so.
Even longer, yeah. It's the short hair, the mustache, the oftentimes the beard, the work shirt, the blue jeans, the cowboy boots, or the leather look. Leather and Western, that whole thing. Yeah, sure.
Where do you think it comes from? Because it's new. I mean, that was never a gay male stereotype before.
Well, what's interesting is that when gay liberation began in 1969, many gay theorists imagined that what would emerge would be a kind of androgynous look, and that gay men would feel free to express their femininity, and women in turn would feel free to express their masculinity. In fact, that didn't happen. This very different thing did happen, but I think it's actually understandable now through hindsight, and that is that I feel that the negative stereotype that gays in a self-hating way tried to conform to before gay liberation was the image of the sissy, and that once those shackles were thrown off, that gay men felt free to revel in their own masculinity, and perhaps they've gone overboard, but I think that they have become in many ways the strong man that they used to yearn for. I mean, they have embodied in themselves the same virtues that, I mean, when I was a boy in the 1950s, most of the gay men that I knew as a teenager wanted to go to bed with a straight man. That was the great thing, to find a really masculine straight man. And now most gays are not at all interested in straight men, and the image of masculinity that they want to project, that they want, is the one that they're now projecting.
It's always been an interesting phenomenon to me, because as a woman, that kind of macho presence has had a very oppressive, negative connotation to me, and I've always wondered if it felt that way to any men within the gay community, or if that's just a woman's point of view looking at it.
Well, I think it is very different in the gay world than it is in the heterosexual world, because I think that that look, traditionally, in heterosexual society, represents the strong, unfeeling, nonverbal man who is physically a bully and who is in control of the money and power. It's a look of power. And I think that whereas that is attractive to gay men sexually, when you have two such men together, neither of whom owns the other, and neither of whom is controlling the income, neither of whom is beating up the other or abusing the children or in any other way fulfilling the straight stereotype of that kind of macho man, it's a very different affair. You know, I mean, I think it's less oppressive to gays. However, I do know gay men who, particularly those who are slight or who are effeminate, who feel quite scorned by this new kind of gay macho fascism, as they call it, and who long for either return to the good, bad old days or to some new synthesis in which, in fact, a kind of androgyny will emerge again. I think that, that the look is dying, and I think it's partly because of the very word clone. As you know, a clone is someone who's identical to someone else, and the I think that that once a word emerged for it, a derogatory word, and now people will call themselves clones, and they'll say, oh, gee, I have to admit to you, I'm really looking for another clone. But they say it with an ironic and apologetic smile now, and I think the very word is going to point up what kind of silly conformism it's getting to be.
Well, I wonder if that image is dying, if part of it isn't that the straight community has, without knowing where it's come from, picked up on it. And I remember seeing, you know, people dancing around to the song Macho Man and having no sense that that macho referred to an image within the gay community, that most of that group, at least originally, was gay.
Oh, sure, and you hear 13-year-olds...
Some of the biggest homophobes were dancing away to it. I have no idea.
Oh, sure, you hear 13-year-old straight kids singing I Want to Get It On at the YMCA, you know. I mean, all those songs from the Village People, which have a kind of gay allusions built into them, of course, became very popular in the straight world. And I do think that look has somewhat caught on in the straight community, but not really. I mean, I think one of the interesting things is that gay men used to be a conduit for fashion in America from Europe to the rest of the country. I think it used to go this way, that there were European designers, then in America there were gay men who picked up things, then there were movie stars and television personalities, straight, who picked up that look, and then finally it filtered down to straight ordinary men in the country. But now I think one of the funny side effects of gays being so visible and being out of the closet is that now people do recognize who gay men are, and straight men don't want to look like gay men. It's not that they necessarily hate them, it's just that they don't want to be confused with them. And so, oddly enough, now there are fashions that are true of the gay community that don't seep down. Sometimes they do to straight teenagers, but they very seldom go now to straight adult men. And so the conduit of fashion, the pattern, the traffic flow has changed a little bit.
You mentioned that in San Francisco, sometimes politicized gays at this point will jeer at what you're calling clones, men who have that macho look, the standard costume for it. What does that indicate to you, that the look's dying?
No, I think that's really a political statement. It's saying that it's the politically active radical gays saying to the clones, look, you people aren't active, you're not registered voters, you don't do anything for the gay community, you have oppressive attitudes toward women and toward other men, you're interested in sex roles, you're interested in violence. In other words, it's the feminist part of the gay community, or let's put it, those gay men who have a feminist consciousness, who are objecting to the macho look as being kind of dim-witted and oppressive.
Let's look at another image, and this image has been traditionally the stereotype of gay men, and that's the swishy image, the limp wrist, lisping, swishy image. that's a stereotype. A lot of people say that stereotypes exist because they're partially true. To what extent are there men within the gay community who fit that stereotypical image, and how do you react to that as a stereotype?
Well, I think it's true of some gay men. Of course, it's also true of many straight men, and one of the painful aspects of homophobia in this country, dislike of homosexuals, is that many straight men who happen to appear to be gay, that is, who happen to be effeminate, oftentimes are considered to be gay and mistreated in this country. They don't get jobs, they have a hard time getting dates with women, and so on. And I do think that part of the sissy look, the kind of strange, very tight-assed way of walking down the street, the limp wrist, the sort of oftentimes the lisping voice, I think a lot of these symptoms are symptoms of extreme self-consciousness. I see them in women, too, oftentimes. Women who are uncomfortable with their bodies or uncomfortable with themselves or who feel oppressed. And I think that what we call, in a way, the masculine way of carrying yourself is actually a kind of very unselfconscious, free, athletic, being at home in the world. In other words, it's the look of the victor, the one who's won. And the one who has lost tends to have a constrained and tight and sometimes artificial way of moving. And so it would seem to me that these two looks, rather than being necessarily masculine or feminine, they're more the look of the lord at his ease and the serf who is very uptight and constrained and humiliated.
What's your reading of how people who do act in the manner that we're describing are accepted by men who are politicized within the gay community? Has it become an embarrassing image to have? Is it accepted as a way of acting if that's how you want to act, and of a certain sensibility if that's your sensibility, and however you want to be is perfectly okay as long as you're comfortable with it?
No, I don't think it's been very widely accepted at all. I mean, the effeminate man, and particularly the drag queen, is an embarrassment to most gays. I think this is a very sad thing. I think that lesbians who have objected to drag queens have, at least my heart goes out to them. I understand what they're objecting to. Many lesbians have felt that drag queens are ridiculing women. I don't think that happens to be true. However, at least I have some sympathy with women who feel that, because at least I sympathize with them until they know better. I can see how they might think that's true, and they have a genuine political objection to it. But among gay men, I think the objection is much less supportable, and I think it is really hatred of homosexuality. I mean, of course, we grow up in this society, and gay people, like straight people, also dislike homosexuality. And I think that part of that internalized self-hatred is the hatred of the effeminate man or of the drag queen.
A dilemma I see sometimes developing is that if you speak to someone who's very homophobic and they say, look, you know, I know gay men, they all lisp, they have limp wrists, they're really swishy, you know, they're weird, I don't like that. And you say, well, look, there's many different kinds of gay men. Some gay men have this kind of appearance and this kind of taste. Many gay men are into a very macho thing. Many gay men wouldn't fit any stereotype or any image that you describe, just as, you know, everybody has an individual thing. Then you meet someone who is gay and they conform to one of the stereotypes. And the homophobic person who said, oh, all gay men like that, have someone else to point to and said, see, I told you, that's what it means to be gay.
Yes, of course. And I mean, I myself used to, when I was younger, have an awfully hard time spotting lesbians. And so the only ones I would spot were the sort of truck driver butch types who had tattoos on their arms and wore T-shirts and slick back Elvis Presley type hair. I would say, oh, there is a lesbian. Of course, now I know many, many more lesbians, and they fit no stereotypes. But I would never have been able to pick them out before. And I think you're quite right that most straight people don't know how to spot gays. In New York, and in many large cities, I do think sophisticated straight people do know how to do it. I think they don't always know how they do it. For instance, one way that I think that straight people are able to tell that someone is gay is that he's usually thinner. I mean, gay men are usually 10 to 15 pounds thinner than their counterpart who happens to be straight. I mean, a 40-year-old gay man probably weighs 160 pounds, whereas the straight man weighs 180. I mean, it's odd because I think it's just a side effect of gay men being more interested in body culture and their self-appearance and so on, in general.
Have you met many gay people who just resent being part of any group and who are comfortable being openly gay but who don't want to be typed as a political gay or of any, who don't want to belong to any definable group?
I have met some, but I must say that at this point in history, I think that it's very difficult to be a self-respecting gay man who... let me put it this way. When I meet a gay man who talks that way and who says, I'm not interested in other gays, I don't want anything to do with them, I tend to think this guy has not come to terms with his homosexuality. And 9 times out of 10, I think I'm right, that I would hope that in the future one wouldn't have to be interested in gay politics, gay liberation, gay solidarity. But at this point, I think that I know that, for instance, when I was teaching down at Johns Hopkins, I was only there 2 days a week. I was commuting from New York. Nevertheless, I felt that I was the only gay person in an all-straight world when I was down there, and I would begin to get depressed, much as I used to be depressed when I was a teenager. And I thought, I really can't stand this. So I looked up and found a gay student group on campus, and I would go to their meeting. Even for that one evening a week that I was down there, I felt that I had to be in touch with other gay people. Now, some people might regard that as extreme, but in my own case, I feel that when I'm not asserting my gay identity, I tend to sink back into some sort of depression. And I know even relatives of mine have said to me, why don't you write about things other than this gay stuff? But I need to assert that kind of identity, and I think gays in general do.
See, that's the thing that I think many people confuse with flaunting it. You know, why do gays always have to insist that they're gay and always have to openly show and carry signs saying that they're gay?
And I think that they look at their own sexuality, straight people, and they say, I don't go around advertising my heterosexuality. But I think that's as nonsensical as a white saying to a black, why do blacks have to be so assertive about their independence? We whites are. Well, of course not. I mean, the master class needn't be.
Let's talk a little bit about sexuality and relationships. Many gay men, and again, not all gay men, many gay men are into having many quick sexual relationships with men that are fairly anonymous. You know, intimacy is not the key here. It's the sexuality that's the key. I wonder what you think is behind that phenomenon or approach to sexuality, and I call it a phenomenon because it seems to be something that exists amongst a wide range of gay men.
I would say it's maleness. And by that I mean that I think that one of the interesting things about the lesbian community and the gay male community is that it permits us to see what men would be like, what American men at least would be like, if not trammeled by the influence of women. And it allows us, conversely, to see what women would be like and if they were not responding to the demands and expectations of men. So that, for instance, the book Homosexualities, which came out 2 or 3 years ago, and that was part of the Kinsey Institute, showed that, on a very small sample, mind you, but nevertheless, it was suggestive, that the average gay man in San Francisco, who was, I think, maybe over 25 or something, had had at least 500 sexual partners, whereas the average lesbian had had fewer than 10. The average gay man had sex 3 times a week. The average lesbian had sex once a week, and so and on and on. But I think that rather than this being a phenomenon of gays and lesbians, it's really what men are like. I think that many straight men I know are envious of gay men, not because they want to be gay, by no means, but they would like to have that much sex, straight sex in their case, and they would like it to be that uncomplicated. And I think that though many of the straight men who very violently disapprove of gay promiscuity are really envious, and it's sort of sour grapes.
Oh, what else does it say to you that men are more interested in sex and women less interested in a large number of sexual encounters, according to these numbers that you're giving us? Do you think it's a reaction to sex roles the way they've been initially taught to the people who are now gay? Or do you think it's just a basic physical difference between men and women?
We don't really know. But, I mean, I'm sure there's the cultural training plays some role in that. I think certainly boys growing up are told by their fathers that, oh, well, you know, just because you go to bed with a girl, son, doesn't mean you have to marry her. And whereas a girl is certainly not usually taught that in a traditional family. However, I do think there are really biological differences between men and women. I think that the level of excitability in men is much higher. I mean, that is, men are much more easily triggered into a state of sexual excitement, and nothing triggers them more easily than novelty. And I don't think that is so true of women. I mean, I've had heterosexual experiences too, and I feel that with women there's usually some period of courtship, there's usually some getting to know them. I do feel that spiritual and intellectual and social values all play a much larger role than they do in male-male encounters, or than they do in the male mind in general. I think someday maybe some sociobiologist will have an interesting thing to say about this. I mean, for instance, he may say that one of the functions of male promiscuity is that if a male were carrying within him a gene that was a beneficial mutation, that it would be to the advantage of the whole species for it to move as quickly as possible through the gene pool. Whereas since women can only bear a child once a year, promiscuity is a little less important for them. Do you see what I mean? I mean, there may be some evolutionary advantage to men being promiscuous and women not being.
Do you have any moral point of view on this? Many people feel that it's simply a bad thing to engage in quick and impersonal sex, and that sex must be equated with intimacy, and that we must teach people about that relationship between sex and intimacy so that teenagers aren't overly promiscuous and so that adults aren't overly promiscuous.
No, I have no moral feelings about it at all. I mean, my only feelings are that people should do what suits them, and I think that some people, for instance, Charles Silverstein, who wrote The Joy of Gay Sex with me, is now doing a book on gay couples, which is very interesting. And in that book, he studied hundreds of them. He makes a distinction between home builders and excitement seekers. And the excitement seekers are those gay men who really don't want a partner and who really want to go out and have a lot of fun with different people every night. The more the merrier. And who tend to get very claustrophobic and unhappy when they're in relationships. Whereas the home builders are those who really like domesticity. And it seems to me that the only tragedy is when a person, let's say a young, impressionable person who really wants a partner, falls in with a very fast crowd and feels he must do that. He's not doing what suits him. And I think that people should simply find out what is true to them without putting labels like mature or immature on that behavior. I think it's just a matter of temperament, really.
Amongst men who are into a lot of different sexual relationships, there is a pretty high degree of sadomasochism in S&M relationships. Would you say that there's a higher ratio of that, like within the gay community, than within the straight community? I don't know.
It'd be very interesting to know. I mean, of course, we don't really have figures on this, and I think I was on a call-in talk show in New York not too long ago, and somebody who called in was a straight young man who was involved in S&M, and he said, one of the nice things about you gay people is that you've allowed us straight S&M people to come out of the closet and to identify ourselves. Now there are 3 straight S&M bars in New York.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't
and,
know that.
Plus, I know women who work at a place called Show World on 42nd Street, which is a kind of sex department store where they have live sex acts and so on. And the most popular acts are the ones in which women beat men. I mean, there are a lot of straight men who are masochists, but there are very, very few straight women who are sadists. And so the men usually end up having to pay for it. It's one of those sad things in the world that the supply doesn't equal the demand. But I do think that there's a great deal of sadomasochism that runs throughout our society. I think it's more overt in the gay community, but I think it may be developing within the straight community. Now there's a new phenomenon that's being discussed, and that's lesbian S&M, which we never imagined existed. But apparently that's quite a big scene. that I had no idea about. But no, I see an awful lot of straight S&M.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about S&M? Do you think it's a negative manifestation of feelings? Because it does tie in so closely to pain and to degradation and to force, and even if it's just the image of all of that, it's the image of things that we have very negative associations about.
Yes, well, I think that it shades off into something that is oftentimes self-hating and or destructive of other people, or that's very cold, or a kind of confession of being really jaded, I think. Sometimes it's the sauce piquant to awaken a very jaded taste. But I don't think that is in general what is happening in S&M. My basic feeling is that people who are involved in the S&M scene, first of all, the amount of actual violence and actual pain is much smaller than you would imagine. A lot of it is fantasy. I mean, I think about 90% of it is fantasy. And in a way, two gay men could have rather ordinary gay sex, and yet if one of them was whispering in the other one's ear a kind of very aggressive rap, that would constitute S&M sex. And that probably is what happens most often. Plus, maybe some of the apparatus and some of the costuming and so on, a kind of general atmosphere of the macho and the menacing. But I think that most of the S&M men that I know seem to me to be gentler and sort of washed clean of the real violence that runs throughout our whole society. There's an interesting passage in Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon, in which a sadist says to another one, "Why does our society make so much fun of S&M more than any other sexual vice? It's because they, that is, the people who run the country, don't want these feelings wasted on mere sex." If you think of it, our whole society is arranged in forms of domination and submission, whether it's parents and children or boss and employee, rich people and poor people, whites and blacks. And the sadomasochist, I happen to feel, is someone who is oftentimes very disturbed by this phenomenon. And in fact, the only study I've seen of gay male sadomasochists has shown that they tend to be college educated. They tend to be extremely sensitive to the sight of pain. They oftentimes have been vegetarians and or pacifists. And they oftentimes are, if not liberal in their politics, at least libertarian. This is a far cry from the Nazi image that we imagine that sadists actually are. Well, in any event, how can it be that a man who is so sensitive to the sight of pain should then be involved in sexual pain? And my feeling is that sex plays a kind of strange role in our life. That is, it doesn't necessarily repeat. We don't repeat at night what we do in day. It is oftentimes the obverse and a way of exorcising some of these feelings. And my own feeling is that S&M is a way of controlling, exorcising, understanding, getting rid of the real S&M that runs throughout the society. As a consequence, oftentimes the sadist and the masochist is a much freer and gentler and less hate-filled person than the one who has never experienced it.
Now, in a film like Cruising, we have the equation of S&M and real brutality. You don't think that is a
No,
a
I think
true
it's absurd.
Equation.
I mean, for instance, a straight person looking at Cruising, I haven't seen it, but from the stills I've seen and the descriptions I've heard, I would imagine that the straight person looking at Cruising would think that here are these really tough murderers living down here by the dock. They're probably poor. They're probably violent. They're probably psychopaths. In fact, most of them are commodity brokers. I mean, most of them are advertising men or executives who love to go to the opera. I mean, if you go to any opera by Richard Strauss, for some reason Strauss is a great favorite of sadomasochists, the first 14 rows at the Metropolitan are taken up by men and heavy leather and chains. I mean, these are not these bullies that the movie presents it as. They're usually rather cultured people.
What I've been thinking about lately is, you know, the group Women Against Violence Against Women. There's a number of groups, women's groups in different cities around the country, that are trying to protest against and, if possible, even eradicate pornography in which there are violent acts against women, and that would include sadomasochistic pornography. Of course, films with dismemberment is the ultimate in that, but I think that they are also referring two sexual parts in films where there's pain that's dealt out. And the equation has always been is that this is something that men do to women. Now, if we're looking at a male culture in which men go to bed with other men, and this kind of S&M is happening between men, what does that mean about how we have to think of sadomasochism in the heterosexual community and sadomasochistic acts happening in heterosexual pornography? And do we have to rethink or not if that's symbolic of the way men regard women, or is it just what a lot of men want from sexuality? And in some people, that's a heterosexual wanting, and in others, it's a homosexual wanting.
I see. I think it's a very complicated issue that requires many, many distinctions. I mean, one of those I would make is that it seems to me that magazines, for instance, are less controversial because less likely to stir up a whole crowd of people than movies. Now, I don't quite know how I feel about this. I mean, I do believe very strongly in the First Amendment, that people should be able to make and print and publish and buy whatever publications or whatever movies they want to. However, another little part of me says, I don't really like sitting in an audience and watching a movie where a woman is degraded. It seems to me there's something wrong with it, and I don't like seeing teenage boys in the row ahead of me learning that this is the way to treat a woman, to slap her around and so on. Now, it does seem to me that in real sexual sadomasochism, that if we return to life for a moment, as opposed to pornography, that what is oftentimes going on is that the two partners actually are fond of each other. I mean, there are many couples who are sadomasochistic who do not carry that over into their life. I mean, the masochist doesn't stay around scrubbing the floors all day while... In fact, it's oftentimes the reverse. I mean, the masochist will sometimes be the older one, the one with the better job, even the one who is the sort of bossier one in their social life. I mean, in other words, it's a very specific sexual behavior that does not conform or carry over to the rest of their lives. And I think, in other words, it's a game. It's a kind of fantasy. This seems to me very different from the image of, let's say, a woman that might be in the Rolling Stones ad in the black and blue all over, where she is covered with bruises and she's standing there on a giant billboard, and this is the way we see women. We're supposed to somehow think this is sexy. Or when a Hustler magazine cover shows a woman being fed into a meat grinder and coming out as hamburger on the other end. To me, this is really offensive. It doesn't seem to me like a sexual game anymore. It seems to me like a statement about how I like to see women. And I don't like to see women in that position, and therefore it offends me. But I think that women against pornography and women against violence against women have some good points, but they've also maybe gone overboard. I mean, I think that sometimes they begin to sound like Puritans on the right who are really opposed to sex in general. For instance, the women against pornography in the Times Square area have a slideshow in which they will show a picture of two teenage girls, and it's a clothes ad, and the girls are certainly very sexy looking, and they're making kind of coquettish moves at the camera, and the representative from Women Against Pornography will say, see, here these women are being presented, these young girls are being presented in a sexual pose, and this is violence. This is violence against women. Rape is being invited. Now, I think that's complete nonsense. I mean, first of all, it's an ad for girls' clothes that's supposed to appeal to girls and to their mothers. It's not directed to men at all. Secondly, there's no rape in this picture. I mean, in other words, some of the more extreme feminists sometimes seem to me to regard all heterosexuality as a form of rape. I don't think it is. I think most heterosexuality is simply sex, and both the men and the women like it. I think that there's a kind of weird puritanical extremism that is finally anti-sex and anti-life that is found in many of the feminist groups and by the less thoughtful spokeswomen. And I think the danger is that feminism may become, in an unsuspecting way, an ally of the right rather than keeping its position with the left as it always has. I mean, some of the things they say come very close to what Reagan and other people on the right feel.
You've made some very interesting distinctions. My guest is Ed White, if you're just joining us, and he's the author of a new book called States of Desire, Travels in Gay America, which is about his travels to different gay communities around the country. Do you think that what we're seeing now is, let me just rephrase this a little bit. You say at some point in your book that you think that there's a lot of sex happening in the gay men's community now, and that might change, that this might be a peak point now, and that things might slow down and change around a little bit. This might just be a trend that's in the upswing right now and might be heading for the downswing. What do you think?
Of sex in the gay community?
Of the amount of sex. Of the promiscuity, I should say. Quick sex with a lot of different partners and emphasis on novelty within sex.
Well, I've heard people say that. I've heard some very intelligent gay spokesmen say that they felt that it was a sign of our former oppression that in a time when we, and it's still true for many people throughout the country, that the only place they can get sex is quickie sex in public toilets or in parks and whatnot. And that even when a more favorable climate develops, people still resort to that because they've internalized that kind of oppression. I wonder. I'm not so sure that's true. I think men like to have a lot of sex, and I think it differs from individual to individual. But I think that in general, men are very highly sex creatures, and I think that a friend of mine who is a psychiatrist who deals mainly with gay male patients, many of whom are very young and attractive, says that the most often heard complaint in his office is, I'm not getting enough sex, even though to him it seems like they're having an astronomical amount. But I think men really like to have a lot of sex, and I think they will grab almost any chance for having it. I think that's true for both straight and gay men.
I'm going to ask you a couple of questions that I think are questions for women involved with, like, the feminist art community. Do you think that there's a gay aesthetic? And that's a question that women ask about feminist art a lot. Is there such a thing as a women's aesthetic? And is something gay art if it's done by a gay person, or does it have to express a certain gay content, gay subject matter, in order to really be called gay art?
I think that there have been historically different gay aesthetics which reflect the stage that gays are in at that moment historically. I think, for instance, that in Oscar Wilde's time, the kind of extreme artificiality and preciosity of gay art of that time represented a sort of turning away from the world and a kind of turning into a world of fantasy, highly elaborated, and partly designed to intimidate the naive, straight consumer of this art. It was a way of gays setting themselves up as sort of shadowy and intimidating high priests of art. I think that represents pretty much a kind of reaction by those gay artists at that time against the oppression of their society. I think that camp was a kind of intensification of that. So that camp, the oddest thing about camp is that it declares what isn't obviously great, which in fact looks like junk, to be great. And then obviously important art, it just yawns at. And it decides that some awful grade B movie is really a masterpiece and so on. And I think that that one of the things that is true about camp is how arbitrary it is. In other words, anything that's that arbitrary, again, you must return to the personal whim and the personal taste of the arbiter, who in turn becomes rather intimidating high priest of art. So it's more of the smokescreen being tossed out by gays. Now, it seems to me that young gays today, growing up in a climate of acceptance, of greater acceptance, have moved away from that kind of veiled, intimidating, and complex art altogether to a very bright, shiny, what I would call pleasure machine kind of art. And I think that the disco itself is the ultimate expression of that aesthetic. I mean, with brilliant lights, with perfectly controlled and blended music, with all of the kind of sonne lumiere aspects of a machine designed to create pleasure that's bright, that's shiny, and that works every time. It seems to me that a novel like Felice Picano's The Lure, which has a kind of bright, energetic quality of very rapid, pulsing drive and a lot of extreme behavior, all crammed into a tight, suspenseful plot, that this is also the kind of new gay art, the pleasure machine aspect of it. So in other words, I would say there is no single gay aesthetic, that it differs according to the particular historical moment that gay people find themselves in.
Do you think that most of the consumers or people who are interested in this type of art are gay themselves, or do you see a lot of people in the gay arts community having broad audiences that encompass both gays and straights?
I think there are many. Well, the odd thing is that I think that there's something artificial about talking about gay art, because there are gay artists, writers, painters, and so on, who are identified as such, who have specifically small gay audiences. So there's gay art. There's also art, which happens also to be gay. I mean, that is this country's leading playwrights, this country's leading novelists, this country's leading painters, and composers particularly, all happen to be gay. However, they're not out of the closet. They're not identified as such. And so they are also gay, but they don't usually tend to have gay content in their work.
This is a kind of interesting phenomenon, because there's a stereotype in American culture that a lot of the men who are in theater and a lot of men who are painters or dancers are gay. Yet, so few men in those professions seem to really come out and to let their audiences know that they're gay. And a lot of times people who you think are probably gay show up with women on their arms at grand openings or at...
This is particularly true of movie actors. It's less true of theater actors. Movie actors are one of the most oppressed groups in the world because audiences simply do not want to see a gay man get the girl at the end of the movie. And I suppose it's understandable, but I think it's partly a result of the fact that our audiences are naive for movies, and they tend to identify the private life of the actor with the role that he's playing on the screen. So as a consequence, movie actors are among the most closeted. I mean, there's a real terror of being exposed among Hollywood actors.
So this is in part because they're afraid that the audiences won't react to them in heterosexual roles on the screen.
Absolutely, and they're absolutely right. And it begins right in Hollywood. That is, they won't even be cast for those roles once they get to be known to be gay. And certainly we can look at many men, for instance, Farley Granger or Tab Hunter, who it became known back in the 50s that they were gay, and their very brilliant and promising careers were ruined, and they disappeared. If I were an actor living in Hollywood and I wanted to make $1 million and be well-loved, I would never come out. I mean, there's just no way, because you could then not make any more movies except playing gay roles.
Do you think that people in the publicity departments at the studios or the people doing publicity for individual films basically advise gay people about that?
Absolutely.
That they're going to have a hard time?
And their agents. For instance, a young actor I know who's quite successful in Hollywood, his agent said, no bars, no baths, and appear at every important engagement with a girl on your arm.
Sure, and when you're famous, photographers are always trying to capture you at candid moments, and you never know when there's someone following
That's
you
right.
with a camera trying to get
That's
you.
That's right.
You mentioned in your book that there are some questions you feel you really have in common with heterosexual women and with your women friends. Can you go over what some of those questions are?
Well, I think that one of the things that comes up is how much does one owe one's friends and how much does one owe one's lover? For instance, that's a thing that I know a lot of straight, single women in New York who have very intense relationships with their women friends and who then, let's say, will pick up with a new male lover. And the question is, what do they owe this guy? Should they, for the length of that affair, should they pretend that they're really married? Should she submit to his taste? Should they entertain together? Or should she see her women friends and pretty much at the same rate, but independently of this man? That kind of question, I think, is something that many gay men have, too, because I think many gay men, particularly those who are promiscuous or who tend to have one short affair and then a lapse of a couple of years and then another affair and so on, the real sustaining force in their life is their friendships. And I think that in the large cities we're seeing that happening more and more with straight people and gay people, that there are these very elaborate networks of friends, extremely intense in a way that people like my parents don't understand at all. They say, well, you should get married or you're going to be very lonely. Oh, I have friends, Mom. Well, yes, but friends. But their idea of friends are a couple that you entertain once a month who come to dinner, and that's that. But the kind of friendships that are developing in the big cities, I think, among single people, both straight and gay, are these kind where you have the daily phone call and even the 3 o'clock in the morning phone call and the intense, intimate exchange, no holds barred, no secrets from each other. And a lot of advice, and a lot of weeping, and a lot of consoling, and a lot of enjoying. And I think that this is something that women, particularly those who have been through the feminist experience, and gay men have in common. They understand this together. I think that many women enjoy being with a gay man because they don't feel that there is always a sexual issue at stake between them, that there's really more companionship. Both the man and the woman have had to deal with the difficult male ego. I mean, because even the gay man, though he is a man, nevertheless, he's having to deal with other men and having to put up with the oftentimes pretentiousness or hard-headedness of men. So there's a great deal of advice that goes back and forth between straight women and gay men about how to handle the man in your life. And anyway, I think they're very kind of happy and cheerful and sustaining relationships, and there's an awful lot in common. There's a wonderful short story by Tennessee Williams called Two on a Party about a gay man and a straight woman who just really love each other and go everywhere with each other and who are really like a husband and wife, except they don't have sex, but they have or maybe they're brothers or sisters or whatever. But anyway, there's total closeness between them, and I see this great deal. Unfortunately, many straight women who don't happen to know gay men imagine that gay men hate women, that they see women as rivals for men, and that they despise them, and that homosexuality is really a form of misogyny. I think there are some gay men for whom that's true, but I think that there are fewer gay men who dislike women than there are straight men who dislike women.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. If you could live in any of the places that you visited, mm-hmm. which places would you choose? Which seemed like a place that you as an individual would feel comfortable in?
Well, I think that I happen to like New York a great deal because I do like the combination of a free gay atmosphere and one that is also heavily artistic, and because I happen to be a writer and happen to be gay. But I can see if my interests are slightly different that the appeal of other cities. For instance, I think Boston is a wonderful city for gays. It tends to be very radical politically. It has an awfully large gay population. I think the presence of so many universities there has drawn a lot of very bright gay people. It's a very beautiful city, the way it's been rebuilt. And it seems to me intelligent, liberal, very attractive place, and affluent. I think Seattle was a big surprise, a delightful surprise for me. I'd never been there before I did the traveling for this book. And I found Seattle a marvelous place for gays. It's a little bit more conservative than a place like San Francisco or New York. Gays are not so visible, though there is a large gay population, and a rather powerful one. And the straight community is quite accepting of gays. Two policemen in Seattle recently tried to rescind a pro-gay ordinance that had been passed a number of years ago. And the voters voted against rescinding this thing by 64%. So, I mean, in other words, a large part of the straight population feels that gays should have rights to get jobs, that they should be able to get apartments, they should be able to live like anyone else. And this kind of liberal atmosphere there, I think, is very appealing. Plus, the city itself is very beautiful. I mean, one can go to work on a boat. There are two mountain ranges nearby. Anybody who's outdoorsy would certainly like it.
There are two conflicting things happening in our society now as far as gays. Gays in many places are getting more open, more free and willing to have the people around them who aren't gay know that they are gay. But at the same time, a lot of people are afraid when they see that happening that, oh my God, there's so many gay people and they're weird and they're different and it makes me uncomfortable and maybe Anita Bryant's right and maybe they shouldn't be in the schools. So you have a growing conservatism at the same time that you have a growing openness. Do you see one or the other of these forces as winning out in the near future? Do you see us headed in one or the other direction more strongly? And we only have a couple of minutes.
I think that things are going to become liberalized for gays, and because I think it's largely a generational thing. I mean, most of the studies that have shown that people over 40 who are straight tend to be very uptight about gays, and those under 40 tend to be rather accepting. They don't care. And I think that there is, in general, what among young people, a feeling that sexuality is a private matter and that it's no big deal. And I think this relaxed atmosphere is going to win out. I hope so.
Ed, we're out of time. It's really been nice to have you here. I'm glad you were able to come to Fresh Air this afternoon. And if you're back in town, I hope you could come back and that we could talk some more. Thanks for being
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Edmund White, and he is a writer. We've been talking about the subject of his new book. It's called States of Desire, Travels in Gay America. And he traveled around the country, visiting gay communities in different cities around the country. He's the author of a few other books I'd like to mention. The Joy of Gay Sex, he co-authored. And is the author of two novels, Forgetting Alina and Nocturnes for the King of Naples. Thanks again for being here. That's it for this afternoon's Fresh Air.